Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. Praise for G's Power Hour, because there's a little power lacking this morning. But anyway, thank you for being with us today. Happy Friday and happy Memorial Day weekend. Please keep those that we lost trying to fight for our freedom in your prayers, and for the widows and widowers and the families left behind. So just make sure that you keep all of those in prayer. We have, before I go forward, it is tomorrow, I believe, the beginning of the tax-free weekend for those that are shopping for hurricane supplies. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later in the show. But right now I want to get to, before I lose power, Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch, who wants to give us a little bit of information this morning. Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
I'm blessed. I am wonderful.
Okay, sounds like there are a few kinks in the system here, but let's press on.
The kink is my cell phone. It's like not, and I was away from my landline. It doesn't want to seem to hold a charge this morning for some reason. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yep. So what you got?
Okay,
you demanded our time today. So what's going on?
What is happening is the police reform executive order that was signed this week by President Biden. As some of the listeners may be aware or remember, that last year Congress failed to agree to a package of reforms to deal with police misconduct. The package was initially dubbed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Once the House passed the proposed bill along to the Senate, it died and has not gotten out of the committee in the Senate, nor is there any hope, in my judgment, of that particular piece of legislation ever emerging from the Senate, or if it does, to be called up for a vote by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader. So in response, President Biden signed a police reform executive order, which contains some of the information and goals that the legislation, which stalled, contained. And so I wanted to go over some of that legislation, some of those provisions, rather, so that we would know what is there. But I will say that what this executive order contains is somewhat similar to its predecessor, which was an executive order signed by former President Trump called the Safe Policing for Safe Communities Executive Order. So when I looked at both, they looked very similar with two exceptions. So let me begin by delineating what the present order does. First of all, President Biden's order vacates, or rescinds the Safe Policing Force, Safe Communities order that was signed by President Trump. President Biden's order, what it does is it does not apply to non-federal law enforcement agencies. In other words, the order only has teeth in effect for federal police officers. Second, the order specifically bans chokeholds and what is known as carotid artery restraints unless deadly force is authorized. In other words, where deadly force is in fact something that can be used, the order does allow the police officer to actually use this type of restraint on an individual. But there has to be a justification to apply deadly force to begin with before using that particular maneuver on an individual. The order also contains what is known as a no-knock warrant provision. The order states that there are limitations. It doesn't rule out or try to persuade agencies from using the no-knock warrants. What it does is the order places limitations on federal officers who use these no-knock warrants, and when they are used, that documentation should follow or precede the order to use this no-knock warrant, which indicates when, why, and where and how the warrant was utilized on an individual. That provision is in direct response to the Breonna Taylor no-knock warrant scenario where they went into Ms. Taylor's home, law enforcement officers that is, and also confronted her boyfriend and eventually wound up firing into her outer window and killing Ms. Taylor. So that provision is in the police reform executive order, which was recently signed. In addition, there are a number of incentives in the order itself. And these incentives are offered to law enforcement agencies that abide by the executive order. And the incentives are grants, which are tied to adherence to the order. This is perhaps the most meatiest part of the order because you're getting to the monies, which will be utilized by the federal government in the form of grants that a lot of local agencies depend on for their operations. And if the local agencies agree to abide by the requirements and the provisions within the order, then the money will continue to flow or perhaps increase. If they don't, it appears that some of the grants may slow down or those grants may be eliminated altogether. That's a big deal. The order also creates a misconduct database. And what that does is it requires the federal agencies to submit their officers' records into this database so that their backgrounds can be reviewed by other agencies and also by municipalities if they would like to tap into the federal database when hiring new officers or when making decisions about certain policy provisions pertaining to those new officers. Local agencies could also contribute to and review the database as needed and incorporate that database into their own municipal divisions for purposes of checking out police officers. For example, if you got one officer who got terminated for use of force violations, or this officer perhaps just could not meet the credentialing standards, and he goes to another police agency and applies and never mentions was that he resigned while a investigation was ongoing, or that he resigned in lieu of a termination, or that perhaps he was even terminated. This database will allow agencies, both federal and state, to take a look at the backgrounds of these officers so that you can kind of weed out the bad guys and make an informed decision regarding the new hires. The executive order contains also a body camera provision for federal officers. We've spoken, I believe, the last time you and I got together, G, about these body-worn cameras and whether there was some mandatory provision in Florida which required officers to wear these devices on their persons when they're at work. And I told you that there was not, and there is not. This federal executive order does contain a provision which requires all federal officers to be outfitted with these body-worn cameras. We call them BWCs. That's a big deal because in the earlier order that former President Trump signed, the Safe Policing for Safe Communities order, this was not a part of that particular executive order. So this is new. This is new. I wanted to bring that to your attention because it just simply was either overlooked or deliberately left out of that prior executive order. Now, the next thing that the order does is it creates new standards for agency accreditation and officer certifications. The uniformity of the accreditation is important so that the agency operates the same in Tallahassee as it does in Orlando or Palm Beach. You want to make sure that the standards are at a certain level and that they don't fluctuate and there's no difference between the way we police here as opposed to the way we police somewhere else. That way, we can hold all the officers to a certain heightened standard, and this order seeks to do that. And it also seeks to require certain certifications of the officers in the field so that we're not, like, in one place bringing on someone who just barely meets the standards, and we're putting them out there. We're raising the bar, but this is only as to federal agents or federal officers. This is not a requirement for state officers, so this accreditation is not something that is going to apply to state agencies at the moment. However, if the states and if these municipalities within our particular states decide to adopt the executive order, then again, grants start flowing, the standards will be the same, and we begin to get gradual uniformity throughout the states, which will be consistent with that standard put in place at the federal level. The last thing that I wanted to address is that neither President Biden's or former President Trump's order addresses what is known as qualified immunity. That was one of the biggest problems which stalled the legislation in the Senate, in the United States Senate. The qualified immunity basically protects a police officer from a lawsuit if that police officer did not violate a clearly established law or legal standard which resulted in the misconduct. And that is a very difficult hurdle for practitioners to get over when we bring lawsuits against officers in their individual capacities. And the courts are not very kind to police liability plaintiffs' lawyers when we are attempting to hold officers accountable for their actions. This order does not further the ability of my practice to move forward against those officers who are at the business end of these guns that are killing people or making terrible decisions about their conduct in the field. So neither order, neither the Trump's order or Biden's order, addresses this particular troublesome area. And of course, the legislation that stalled in the U.S. Congress, it didn't get out, so we don't have that to rely on either. So that is those are the highlights of the both orders, particularly the order regarding the police reform that President Biden signed, I believe, on Wednesday.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the executive orders and how they really impact having some sort of continuity or consistency, because I know that's one of the pet peeves that my husband has, is that, you know, these executive orders come and go as the administrations come and go. How does that impact what you do?
It doesn't create a means for a lawsuit against an agency or an officer. But what it does is it creates things that, as a practitioner, I can use in order to now perhaps settle a claim or that I may use to bring litigation, which might be something which I will prevail in. For example, you know, agencies that will now receive a grant, which will be increased or which will continue, provided that they adhere to an order, may get a body-worn camera that now officers are required to wear. And that body-worn camera will now afford me the opportunity to see what happened rather than to rely on a written report about what happened. So that is one advantage. Another advantage is that this database, this misconduct database, affords, again, me to take a look at an officer's background, or it might even prevent that police officer from even being on the street to begin with if the agency elects to participate in the database because there are incentives to do so. Now we've got this flow of information which will bad seed, so to speak, from ever being planted in the ground. And also, if it's planted, it allows me as a harvester to cut it off at the stalk, because now I can see that, like, listen, you should have never hired him. So there's a negligent hiring claim that I can include in the complaint. And you knew this person was a bad seed, so you should have supervised that individual properly, which allows me to file a negligent supervision claim. And you knew that this person had problems with police excessive force to begin with. So now I'm looking at you as an agency. Like, you, if you knew that this officer had, like, four bad shootings, and you knew that all of those shootings, like, jeopardized your department, and then you kept him on, or you hired him, I mean, knowing that this officer had this horrible background. Now, like, we're looking at the agency. So it kind of opens up the lens, so to speak, for the practitioner to make some decisions about how we litigate and, in turn, how it will impact our community.
So I wanted to ask about the cameras and stuff. How, in the video from the cameras, how long are agencies required to keep the video?
That is a very this is a very fluid area. There is no uniform standard for retention. Each police agency makes their own decisions regarding the staging of those particular types of records, and then the destruction of those particular types of records. That is something that is being formed as we speak. This executive order is kind of the touchstone for the federal agencies to begin that process, and in time, the agencies will promulgate some form of rule, which will then set a standard for how long these particular records are kept. If the local municipalities adopt this executive order, then those municipalities will then begin to establish a general order or directive within that respective agency for retention of those records. So we're in the incipient phases, G. Is nothing that's rock solid right now, but we're getting there.
Okay, so let me liken this to shopping for the perfect meal, so to speak. And, you know, you're shopping for the perfect meal in terms of the perfect police reform, and you have the Trump aisle, and you have the Biden aisle, and then you have just an area where there's just other possibilities. What would you pull from, let's first talk about the Trump aisle, what things did you find that worked that you would pull and keep and put into your cart before checkout?
Oh. I have to give Trump kudos for the mental health homelessness and addiction initiative that was in the Safe Policing for Safe Communities order. That particular piece of documentation specifically recognized that there was a problem and had been a problem for some time with law enforcement encountering individuals who were impacted by mental health issues, and that these officers lacked the training to respond appropriately to those particular crises. And the order itself required that all agencies, if they were to adhere to the order, establish training to inculcate the officers to what they would possibly see in the field. In addition, the order established co-responder programs that would work in conjunction with the police agencies so that those social services programs, the Baker Act, medical care facilities, and also the crisis counselors who are on call whenever there is some type of mental health problem in the field would be contacted, that they would all work together in unison. And finally, what his orders did was it increased the capacity of social services workers at all levels. It aspired to do that. Now, I don't know whether the social services agencies actually did what the order mandated, but, you know, those areas that I just mentioned were huge. That's huge because we do have a mental health issue that's out there. You always hear that, you know, people are troubled and the police are called. And when the police show up, for whatever reason, they come guns a-blazing. And, you know, they don't know how to deal with the person, you know, when they go up the stairs and they see that person sitting on the edge of the bed with a butcher knife, you know, kind of looking, you know, in dazed. The first thing the police officer does is he pulls his weapon. And then, of course, the person who they're coming to attend to, you know, that person, you know, may stand up or may walk towards the officer, and now we have a shooting, you know, that kind of thing. So that's a big deal, I think. So I would take that away from the Safe Policing for Safe Communities order from Donald Trump and put it into President Biden's order. That's one thing. All right. You want more?
Sure. Whatever you have from the Trump file, let's hear it, that you would take to put in your cart.
There is another grocery item that I would select and pop right in the cart. There was confidential medical health care services for police officers, because there are people who don the blue uniform or the green uniform, if you're in Florida, who are in need of mental health services. And there's a stigma that if the officers, you know, attain some type of psychological or psychiatric counseling, that they are going to be ruled to be incompetent and not trustworthy on the job, and, you know, that they're going to be put behind a desk, or they might even be asked to resign. Moreover, there's an issue with respect to guys like me who will sue an officer for something that takes place. And one of the things I'm looking for is that officer's suitability to be in the field to begin with. And I'm looking at mental health records. So what do the officers do? They don't get the counseling that they need. You know, they're human beings, just like everybody else. You know,
I was
going to
say,
suffer from. Go ahead.
They need it regularly and more than the average layperson, because they encounter so much more than the average layperson in terms of crime and in terms of, you know, having to witness, you know, bloody scenes and having to witness dysfunctional families and a whole array of things. So if anyone needs the support, the mental counseling and emotional support, it's the police officers.
I agree. These men and women, they're lifting heavy loads. And, you know, they're every day, like you said, you know, they're seeing horrific things that, for the average person, would amount to post-traumatic stress. whenever you see this stuff, you know. And, you know, I can't tell you the number of times that I've sat in a deposition across from a police officer and I've questioned a person. And, you know, you see the eyes turn red and the water, like, fill up in their eyes. You know when you hit a nerve. You know, like, uh-oh, you know, something happened. And you just stay right there, you know, and you just keep asking questions right there because you know that nerve is raw. And then here it comes, bam, they want to take a break. And then you know, we're saying, well, let's not take a break. Let's talk about, you know, whatever, you know, got you fired up here. And then eventually we find out that that officer may have been involved in a shooting, which left an imprint, you know, in that person's mind, you know, that is just not pleasant. And every time something happens, they're triggered by it. These officers have terrible home lives sometimes. You know, they're gone all the time. Or they come home and they can't sleep, you know, and they're like, they live this like isolated life, and some of them get divorced because of that, and that's a problem, you know, because they don't know how to interact with their family, you know. These guys need someone to talk to. They need an outlet. They need a professional to exercise those demons, man, that seem to live inside from time to time, and it should be confidential. And I'm saying that, and I know my police liability brethren would come down on me for this, but I'm saying that it should be confidential because I think that they need help, and eventually they're going to come back and serve our communities, and I think we're better off when these officers are afforded treatment that's good treatment, and they know that it's not going to be something which would be so embarrassing until, like, you know, they just are better off not getting it.
So true, so true. So now you are traveling down. Did you get everything that you needed from the Trump aisle, first of all?
That's about it because they mirror. Both orders sort of mirror each other until you get to that point, you know.
Okay.
I mean, Trump's order deals with use of force and chokeholds, like and information sharing, just like President Biden's.
Okay. So is there anything you need down the Biden aisle or, you know, like you said, are they that close where you've gotten everything that you need from those two aisles before you go to the next aisle?
Well, yeah, in the Biden aisle, I'm going to pick up body-worn cameras because that policy or that particular provision in his order is good meat, man. That's good chewing, you know. I'm telling you, like I already indicated, you know, when you can see when, you know, a report says one thing and you see something different, you know, you got something there. And, you know,
right.
And you know, when daddy's looking, you know, you're not going to act up, you know. So, yeah, I like that. So President Biden gets kudos for that, you know, definitely. So that's what I would take from his executive order. But they both pretty much mirror each other, you know. And I don't know, you know, whether, you know, Trump had, you know, somebody writing this executive order, but, you know, his, he talked about the doubling up efforts in the African American community, to combat misuse of police authority. He goes on, you know, in the preamble of his order, and I had to, like, you know, put my glasses on a little straight. I'm looking at that thinking, like, what? You know, but
he might have gotten some help.
The help was the knee on George Floyd's
the knee
neck.
On the neck, okay.
And right, and the Breonna Taylor incident and the Ahmaud Arbery incident, and the help was like, man, I better address this. I need to do something. And I think that was help. Now, would that have happened like 5 years ago? Or at the beginning of his administration, would he have just decided one day, hey, you know, we need to double up our initiatives in the African American community to deal with police misconduct? Would he have done that on day one or day, you know, day 180? I'm skeptical whether that would happen.
Mm-hmm. Nope, not at all. In my humble opinion, no. But anyway, let's go ahead and take a quick break. We are here with Mr. Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch. We are talking police reform. If you have questions, comments, concerns, the number is 516-387-1944. That's 516-387-1944. G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. We'll be right back. well, maybe we are going to just stick around. So welcome back to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We are talking a little police reform with Kevin Anderson of Anderson & Welch, civil rights attorney here in Central Florida, in East Central Florida. East, I guess you're more south than Central Florida, correct?
Yeah. We refer to ourselves as South Florida, but you can call me whatever, man. I'll respond.
Okay. All right. So, okay, we've gone down the Trump and the Biden aisle, but there are some things missing, right? What some things that you would add to make this police reform complete? Talk about, you know, what would you pull in order to make this more of what you have more teeth that would make it, you know, more meaningful, more useful to attorneys like yourself and to the citizens?
I would assemble a citizen review in each particular area where there is a need for oversight, so that the people who are not a part of the potential lawsuits and therefore, you know, would maybe have an incentive to skew the facts would be checked. So I would allocate on this citizen review board, so to speak, or citizen review panel, a few positions for individuals to be a part of that who are practitioners, people from the criminal and justice and the criminology communities, people from some of the social and civic action networks to be a part of that process to give feedback so that, you know, number one, we feel as citizens that we are being heard. And number two, that if we are not being represented properly in those particular sessions where policies are being made, that that is reported to us so that we understand and we know that we're being ignored and that this is just another sham feature. You know, you've heard that the best disinfectant for a germ or bacteria is the daylight. So let's make things done. Let's put it in the daylight so that we all can see what's taking place. So, you know, and I think, you know, sometimes we forget, you know, once, you know, all the cheering stops when these orders are signed, that someone has to implement everything that's a part of that order so that, you know, we can now put teeth in what we've put on the table. So it's just people don't follow up. And I think that these panels, these people who have skin in the game in these various jurisdictions would be motivated to follow up and to push the leaders, you know, in those particular areas to do the right thing according to the order's mandate. So I'd put something to that effect in the in those particular orders.
Okay, so let's stop there for a minute, because I don't know. To me, that seems like an obvious inclusion into a police reform policy. Why do you think it is not was not included in either of these presidents' you know, policies?
Look, they don't have the authority to order local government to do anything. That's why both orders only pertain to the federal agencies. And at the federal levels, you typically don't have access to the law enforcement officers, such as the FBI or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's so bureaucratic and so cumbersome in order to assemble individuals from the local communities or who are non-government to be a part of that. Until it's, I could see them deciding just not to do that particular act or to put that provision in the executive order. It would have been has been pretty cumbersome. I mean, you've gotten a little pushback on that too, because I don't know if these agencies really want to, you know, be a part of the think tank like that. They kind of want to be told what to do, and they then, you know, and they'll do it. But, you know, they may not like it, but they'll do it, you know. But when you're starting to say, look, you know, open up your doors and, you know, let Kevin and G come in, you know, and we'll sit down and take a look at what you're doing, and we'll tell you whether we like it. If we don't like it, we're going to run outside and we're going to tell everybody that you're messing up. You know, I don't know that that would have gone over too well. So I think that's one of the reasons why you see both orders not containing any provision in those regards.
Okay, so I wanted to go back to something else when we talked about training. And I guess that lack of – because I've always said there's an issue with police training, frankly. Because I think, number one, I think the personality types that are currently drawn to policing need to be, I don't know, looked at a little bit more carefully, a little bit more modified. I think, in my opinion, there are people that are drawn to policing because they think that they are going to get a certain amount of respect that they don't get in their normal lives. By being a police officer, I think they think that people are automatically going to, I guess, revere them or respect them or whatever the case may be. And so I think that police, you know, the career of policing draws certain personality types that maybe don't need to be in law enforcement. So I think there needs to be some sort of weeding out, for one. Number two, I think there needs to be training regularly on more than just making good scores on at the gun range, you know, and also, you know, a little bit more than you know, how many traffic tickets you write, or, you know, other things that, you know, they get, I guess, recognition for or credit for or whatever. I think there's a certain amount of diplomacy or that needs to be taught. You know, I think the healthcare component is crucial. I know there are some areas now where they are having, I guess, people who are trained in mental health to join police officers in, you know, in certain scenarios. So that is helpful, but I think, too, that police officers need to have some of that training themselves. What are your thoughts?
I agree with you. I wholeheartedly agree. I think we're missing the mark with these officers. And as you said, you know, going to a range and being able to hit the target, you know, center mass, that's great. You know, that's going to be needed, but we need other things as well. I've always been a proponent, G, that a police officer should have at least a 2-year degree in something, even if it's just general studies. And I say just, not to minimize what general studies would produce, you know, for an individual at a junior college level. But I'm saying, you know, you could get a associate's degree in criminal justice, which literally addresses what you would expect to some degree when you're in law enforcement. The police officers now, for the most part, need a high school diploma. And in some places, you don't even need that. You can just apply, and if you have a clean background and you're liked, you're hired. And they off you go to these criminal justice standards academies. In Florida, we've got these places where the recruit would go in order to learn how to be a police officer. And the academies are a couple of months long, and they're run just like boot camps. You're allowed to go home at night, but you come back, you know, you're wearing, you know, your shiny shoes, and, you know, you're doing calisthenics. You're learning how to shoot your firearm. You're learning search and seizure techniques and a number of other principles which are germane to the job. I think that in addition to that, you should be required to round yourself by sitting in a classroom and getting at least 2 years of a college education. Another thing I think that police officers should have is they should have periodic mental health screenings, mm-hmm. which are confidential. We've touched on that, you know, already, but I'm going to say it again, that mm-hmm. should be a component of police work, that at least once a year, maybe even twice a year, confidentially, mm-hmm. there should be a screening in order to check you out and to afford you that moment where you could say, you know, I'm glad you asked. Wow, I'm really going through something, Doc. Something like that. I think that's important as well. I think also recognizing these crises that happen. You're going to see homeless people. You're going to deal with people with mental health problems. You're going to deal with people in the field at some point who are addicted to some substance or something. Recognition of these categories and then what is needed to deal specifically with that particular person's demons, so to speak, is, I think, vital as a police officer because they're the ones encountering these individuals. Finally, like de-escalation techniques. Yeah, that is important. You can't shoot everybody. You just can't mm-hmm. shoot everybody.
No, you can't.
There are times you can't.
But you know, can. That's not necessarily good. That's not a good thing. That's not good practice. It doesn't necessarily resolve anything. No, it doesn't. You know, it's just another. You leave another family broken. You know, with the victim, you leave the police officer unwell because they're not getting the regular counseling like we talked about. So, you know, they're processing some of this with not necessarily all the tools that they need to process the situation properly.
I agree. You see these men walking around, you know, and I'm talking about when I say men, I'm using it to also include women. So I'll just say police officers. Or deputies, they look like the Michelin Man. They've got these vests on and all this stuff around their waist and they're mm-hmm. jingling and, you know, and they come out like, you know, like it's getting ready to, you know, be a gang fight or something. But then they wind up shooting somebody. And you're thinking, what was all that about?
mm-hmm.
You look like a kimono wrestler, you know, coming over here. And then you shot somebody? Like, man, you got to go. Sometimes you have to be hands-on. You know, and that's just mm-hmm. the bottom line, you know, without, you know, pulling out deadly force. You know, I said that was the last thing, though, but another important factor is the community-based initiative programs. And I'm going to talk to you, like, about something called PAL, the Police mm-hmm. Athletic League, where
yeah.
you have kids, primarily boys, in the community, mm-hmm. and they want to learn how to box. You know, they want to learn how to, like, you know, play football. And they mm-hmm. want some structured program where they can do those things. That is a big deal, to be able
yeah.
to afford young people an outlet to go and to learn how to do these things. You know, I, you know, participated in football through that type of affiliation when I was when I was a boy. And mm-hmm. I did it for, like, 3 years. And I had a blast. It was great. You know, I definitely enjoyed the other kids who were there with me. It kept me occupied, and I grew more disciplined because if I didn't, like, do what was required of me off the field, I couldn't come on the field. And that was a big deal to me, you know. So here in Palm Beach County, there's an agency. It's the Delray Beach Police Department. I was there doing a toy giveaway program, and it was so hot. Yes, in South Florida in December it gets hot, and
mm-hmm.
you know the chief was there talking to me, and the chief says, "Hey, go over there and get your popsicle." And I said, "A popsicle?" He goes, "Yeah, go over to our van there." And so I went over. They had an ice cream truck. The police department bought an ice cream truck. And they mm-hmm. go around in the community like twice a day. And I went over to the truck. It's a Mr. Softy. It's like this big truck with the slide window, and you hear the engine running, and they've got all these coolers in there. And I looked at it, and there was a police officer wearing a uniform with a gun. He leans down and goes, "Hey, what can I do for you?" "What do you got?" And he said, "They got a bomb pop." And he gives me a pop. I can't believe it. Yeah, he goes, "Yeah, this is what we do, man. We go in the community and we post up and we give, like, the kids ice cream, man, every day." and they've been waiting for us, you know? And I thought, wow, that's kind of cool. Talk about, like, kind of getting to know people. I thought that was really cool. So I'm going to give them a plug. Kudos to them, you know?
Well, now, I also have something that I think that I think needs to happen, too, is they need to go into the prisons and sit down with the prisoners and say, okay, you know, I know, you know, you're no big fan of mine and you know, and that's understandable, but can you tell me why you did what you did? Can you talk to me a little bit about who you are and what brought you to this point and help me understand someone like you so that maybe I can work this out a little differently with the next person that comes along? And, you know, I think they need to go back into the prisons and just sit down and have some discussions with the people that they put behind bars. You know, that's just a
well,
part of mine.
If they do that, I think the defense bar, number one, would have a conniption because a police officer going to an inmate who may or may not still have some aspirations of post-conviction relief, may or may not be involved in an appeal, or in general, may have not been held accountable for everything that they are in prison for, who sits down and starts talking to a police officer, I think you're going to have some constitutional issues that might be a problem for that particular inmate and which will also be raised by the defense community. So I don't know that you know, you let cops just show up at a prison and start talking to people who are in there.
No, I mean, not necessarily just show up, but, you know, just maybe, you know, maybe there's some sort of a structured group talk with attorneys present, and they don't necessarily have to talk about exactly what they did. You know, just like, hey, you know, I ended up in a gang. Why did you end up in a gang? You know, talk about why you ended up in a gang. What was missing? What could have been, you know, where would you have rather have gone instead of being in a gang, and why, or, you know, just something, but just to get to know, because, you know, when they go out into the community, right now they're getting to know, for the most part, the innocents, right? You know,
right.
Or the pre-criminals, if you want to, you know, put it that way or whatever. But you need to maybe talk to the person with the criminal mind to find out how that criminal mind was formed and get a better understanding in terms of who you're dealing with out in the street so that, yeah, maybe, you know, every situation, well, and we know every situation isn't handled with a gun, but there would be fewer situations that would be handled with a gun if maybe the mindset of that particular criminal was understood, so that they could figure out a different way and a different approach, you know, or get other people involved to defuse those situations.
And what made you think of that, by the way? That's like a criminological theorist position. what made you think of that?
I just thought about it. Well, you know, first of all, I have police officers in my family whom I love and cherish dearly. So I don't ever want to see, you know, any of them getting hurt or whatever. I don't also want to see them caught up in a situation that could have been avoided or prevented. I don't also want to see people end up behind bars that don't necessarily need to be behind bars if there was a different way that their situation could have been handled, you know. So I was just thinking about, okay, we talk about, you know, we need police reform. We talk about doing some things other than the training for the guns and the training for the physical fitness and, you know, the writing traffic tickets and all that kind of stuff. You know, what about just meeting face to face? And I'm not saying that the officer that did the arrest of the criminal, I don't think they need to be face-to-face per se, but I'm saying that, you know, maybe there's just some dialogue that needs to happen with the people that are behind bars to kind of get a better understanding of what put them there. So, like I said, that maybe when a police officer goes into a situation, they will remember some of what they heard with the prisoners that they spoke with, and maybe come up with a different idea of how to handle the situation, you know, or a better way to defuse some of those situations.
Okay.
You're talking about reform. Reform sometimes requires thinking a different way or thinking outside of the box, so to, as that saying goes. This may be a different perspective that might help, that might work. And if it doesn't, then throw it out.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to one-up you, all right? I like the scared straight programs where you're grabbing, you know, these young girls and men and boys, and you're throwing them in there, putting mm-hmm. them in a jumpsuit, and it's been a pair of, like, slides that are, you know, too big for them, and off you go. And put mm-hmm. you in there, and we're watching you now, but to just, you know, let them kind of go through maybe 48 hours of what it's like to be in the joint for real. Not like a local jail. I'm talking, take them to like the big house. And literally, you put them in there, and, you know, you're watching them because, I mean, if you don't, really bad things could happen. You know, I've always been concerned about that. But, I mean, you're watching them. You're not listening and kind of being nearby. I'm talking, you're mm-hmm. like watching them for real. Mm-hmm. And just let the chips fall where they may, and just scare the living bejeebies out of these kids, so that they don't ever want to come back. Go ahead.
Well, part of that requires that particular child feels like they have something to lose if they end up in prison. So that may or may not, that's going to work for some. That's not going to work for all of them.
Yeah,
so you've got
to. You're right.
Yeah. And that's why I was saying about getting a better understanding of the circumstances that landed some of those prisoners where they are. I agree, the scared straight. But, I mean, people now have kind of become used to the scared straight method. I mean, I've heard about it. So, I mean, and you know, you've seen the documentaries on how those programs have worked and everything. And so, you know, for some, yes, it'll definitely work. For some, it's like, okay, what else you got? You know, because I don't have anything else. You know, so you're going to have to do better.
Do you have a child who feels that way, you know, when they're exposed to all the negative things that are in a penitentiary? If that child mm-hmm. says, what else you got, you got a problem on your hands. And scared straight or, like, counseling would not have solved it. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. because these are some really terrible places. And what you see mm-hmm. on television is one thing. Gee, I go there, and I talk to some of these people. I represent some of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
Prison is no joke in a lot of places. Mm-hmm. You have different levels, but, man, I mean, the prisons I'm talking about sending them to, I think, they could imagine what would happen if the guards weren't watching them. And I think mm-hmm. that some of these people would go, no, thank you. I'm not doing that, you know. But mm-hmm. I hear you. You know, some people will be resilient and impervious to whatever it is that they're going to experience. So you get a few of those, too.
Yeah. So, okay, well, how can we, though, shore up these executive orders? I mean, like I said, you know, they're going to change almost as much as, you know. I mean, hopefully some of this stuff will stick. Hopefully some of this stuff we can get our lawmakers to actually, you know, firm up and put into actual laws on the books, you know, and not have it where, you know, it gets changed every time we get a new administration. But I'm hoping that some good will come out of that. But like I said, I just think that, and me personally, I just think there's some things that need to start before we get to the executive signing of orders. And one of the things that I mentioned, I know earlier this week, was I'm sorry, I think you need to put religion or spirituality or some form of moral formation, back into the schools. You know, we talk about mental health. Yeah, that needs to come too, definitely. But I think also you need to find some kind of way to put something back in the schools that teaches people about morals and principles. Otherwise, I think we're putting Band-Aids on the problem.
Well, I mean, I think you probably should bring on, a couple of ministers to unpack that theory. Because I'm sure they add more to that discussion than I could add at the moment. I'm not saying I'm faithless, but that's an interesting position, to kind of bring religion back into the school for everybody. What religion would we bring in? Which one? What would it be?
Well, I'm not saying it has to be any particular religion, but you could get, for example, you were talking about getting groups together of citizens. You could get religious leaders together to agree on a curriculum that would help children form, positive, mindsets in terms of how they deal with people. I mean, I think we all agree, and it's not any particular religion, about doing unto others as they would do unto you. And we kind of want more of the positive spin on that than the negative spin on that, I would think. I mean, I think you should get a group of people. So, no, we're not just teaching, Christianity, or no, we're not necessarily just teaching Islam, but what we are doing is taking the best out of all of those and helping to form better people that are coming out of these schools, that teach each other, that teach these students how to treat fellow students and how to treat teachers and principals and even their parents and law enforcement better than what they're doing now.
Okay. All right. And, somehow I don't think that's ever going to happen. I mean, these guys can't even teach about the truth concerning Black history in our school systems.
But somebody's got to start somewhere because we're teaching sex education.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Who thought that was a priority? Take it and make sure that, Black history is a priority. That needs to happen. That, I think people need to stop guilt tripping and just start telling the truth and just deal with the truth, And if you can't handle the truth, that's just a weakness in your character. But don't make it someone else's, problem. So.
All right.
Kevin Anderson, I got to have you back on. We're going to talk because I need you on next month so we can talk more about this and we can talk about some other stuff I need to talk to you about. So thank you for taking the
time
today. Thank you for stepping up. And have a blessed Memorial Day weekend, okay?
Thank you. You as well. Bye.
Talk to you soon. And thank you all for listening. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Like I said, whether you're feasting or whatever you're doing this weekend, please keep everyone in prayer, especially this Memorial Day. Give thanks and prayer for those people that gave their lives, whether they lost their lives or gave limbs or whatever they gave. Keep them in prayer. Keep their families in prayer. The tax weekend for the hurricane season starts tomorrow. And happy birthday, honey. This has been G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. Be well, be safe, be blessed, and please remember all real power comes from God. Take care.